Hello and welcome to Real Talk. I'm your host, Susan McCabe, here with you every Tuesday at lunchtime and at your convenience at voiceofvashon.org/realtalk. Real Talk is the show that explores issues from every angle we can possibly get. Creativity has been around for a long time, and there are other students who are not as fortunate as our students on Vashon Island and whose lives are important stories. Our own Myrna Hecht has been recording those stories. Myrna is a poet, storyteller, activist, and founder of Stories of Arrival, Refugee and Immigrant Youth Voices Poetry Project. She's also been Vashon's Poet Laureate from 2017 to 2019, and she's going to tell us some stunning and unforgettable stories. Good morning and welcome, Myrna. Thank you for being here.
Well, thank you, Susan, and thank you for inviting me. I'm honored to be here.
So, stories of arrival are stories of young immigrants to our country who have come from all over the world. What got you to start collecting these stories, and how did you go about it?
Let's see. A number of years ago, I worked for the Seattle Arts and Lectures Writers in the Schools program, and I was sent to Foster High School, not having any idea at that time, 8 years ago, that it was one of the most language and culturally diverse high schools in the country. And I jumped in, and at that time, there were students, I believe my first class of students at Foster, all refugees, and I can talk about the difference between refugee or asylum seeker status and immigrants. So these kids were all refugees or immigrants, and I realized that they all had remarkable stories. So my work with them that first year was to try to call forth those stories in their own voices. And the school was very pleased with that work, and not a well-funded school, so basically invited me to create any project I wanted with a wonderful ELL teacher, with whom I'm still working. English Language Learning is ELL, and if I could find my own funding. So all these years since that time, I have managed to find my own funding and create this project for these young people to tell their own stories through poetry and now visual art.
Yeah, 8 years of these stories, and apparently you had no shortage of potential authors or subjects during that time.
Right. So these young people come from places of violent conflict, and many of us know those stories maybe through the news media, through what I think of as somewhat distorted lenses and distorted storytelling. And my biggest motivation for doing this work is to remind everyone who hears these stories or sees these beautiful visual stories we're now making that we all know each other better if we hear our own stories, if we understand how we see ourselves. So for refugees and immigrants, as most listeners will know, there's so much written about them. And I think it's really important to break through that and let all people, marginalized and all of us, tell our own stories. In my mind, that is one element of many that could help us create a much more peaceful, embracing, compassionate world, which these days seems to be of utmost importance.
Yeah, pretty hard to come by.
You
mentioned that there is so much written about these young people or about refugees in general. Would you, is it possible for you to characterize, in general even, if the difference between the stories written about them and the stories written from them?
Absolutely. All right. I think that the stories written about them are not stories that have any reciprocity in them. That is, there's no way when marginalized groups are written about, there's no reciprocal way for them to say, wait a minute, that's not us. And if we think about dominant rhetoric right now, it doesn't mean it's the rhetoric of people who are listening or good people really all over the world, but dominant rhetoric about asylum seekers, about refugees, is a bleak story of hunger, poverty, dislocation, displacement, lack of education. It's a story of lack and impoverishment and what to do, and there's no funding for it, and let's send people back. That is one dominant story. When people start telling their own stories, we find that that deep humanity that we all need to value and cherish comes out in those stories. These are stories of courage. These are stories that let all of us grieve because the loss is so dominant in the personal and collective stories when asylum seekers have that story to tell themselves. And I think people lose sight of who we can become when we're a complex, multivalent, multicultural society, and the gifts and talents and wisdom that people from other places have to contribute and bring to us. So the story that we hear is not the story about the dreams, struggles, courage, gifts, contributions. It's a much different story.
What is the age range of the folks from whom you've been collecting these stories? And are they for the most part here on their own or with families?
Oh, that's a great question. The age range is 14 to 18, and some of these young people can be 17 or 18, but just be sophomores or juniors, because living in a refugee camp, you do not have education, or not adequate education, to say the least. So it varies. Some of the young people that I've worked with, including most recently, are here on their own, and some of them are completely on their own. So we call that group of people unaccompanied minors. And some of the young people I work with have been sent by their parents at great sacrifice and loss to the structure of the family in order to live with a foster family who comes from the same village or ethnic group, an auntie, an uncle. Most families will sacrifice greatly in order for their young people to receive an education. And if I can add in my long answer, the irony of that is that this is a group of young people who value education themselves and their families more than any group I have ever worked with, and I've been in this education business for a long time. And now no one's in school. So they've come to this country, all the struggle, all the loss, all the leave-taking, and now they're not in school. And this is the group we read about that got computers last, that still needs to go somewhere in the community for free breakfast, free lunch program. So the deprivation that they left is now upon them in this ironic time of the pandemic.
That's horrifying. Are you continuing to collect stories from them remotely?
Well, yes. One of the beautiful things that's happening is that because the storytelling and poetry, and also we did visual art, this work took so deeply to these young people that a number of them are writing to me directly saying, they call me Miss Myrna, saying, Miss Myrna, here's a new poem I wrote. And then I write back, give suggestions, they write, I write. But some of them are still writing poetry, and I'm also seeing them on Zoom. I want to put a plug in for all teachers everywhere, doing a magnificent and unbelievably difficult job. Teaching is relationship. Teaching is vulnerability. It's the tenderness of the moment. It is not meant to be distance. So I want to say that and thank everybody.
Yes, I agree. And it isn't just teaching. It's
right.
Every human interaction that we have taken for granted in our lives is now a blessed event and and very difficult.
Yeah. Absolutely.
You mentioned the difference between refugees, immigrants, and asylum seekers. For those of us who are not as knowledgeable as you, could you distinguish those different categories?
I'll do my best. So, because I probably will think, oh, I didn't say it quite accurately, because it's really complicated, because the laws are so complicated. And in under the Trump administration, all asylum laws by law are off the table. So I want to be really clear on that, that anything the administration is doing is not according to the asylum laws that are on the books for the United States.
Is it that there are no asylum seekers currently allowed into this country? Is that an oversimplification?
It is. So to immigrate from a country is to make a choice. It still can be because life is unbearable or because of poverty, lack of education, now climate disruption, a better opportunity in the host country one is going to. But one emigrates. One leaves one's country, makes the decision to do that, and goes to the new country, and let's say in general, I mean, there's many other reasons, and hopes of a better life. So that would be to immigrate. To seek refugee status, to be an asylum seeker and seek a legal status from a host country is not to immigrate, but to flee, because you have to then prove to the host country that you deserve the shelter of asylum seeker status. Because to return to your country would mean death or would mean torture, and you would be in definite, proven harm way. Does that make sense?
Yes, for asylum seekers. So how are refugees different?
Well, a refugee is he, she, the group who's fleeing harm's way. So the refugee is seeking asylum status. Does that make sense?
Same thing? Same as asylum seekers then?
No, because the asylum status has to be granted by the host country. So let's say you're in the host country and you're a refugee, but you're waiting to be able to legally stay and apply for the next level on a path to citizenship. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay. So the refugee crisis are these oh my goodness, highest amount of refugees the world has seen, well over 6 million now, and I don't have the right number because it's grown so much. So that's that flood of people in refugee camps. So you can be internally a refugee, internally dislocated. You've had to leave your home, but you're caught somewhere in your own country. So you're a refugee because you're seeking refuge, but you also are an asylum seeker once you reach the host country because you're waiting for that legal status.
That's very clear. Thank you, Myrna Hecht. Mm-hmm. We're talking with Myrna Hecht on The Voice of Vashon at 101.9 FM, KVSHLP, Vashon Island, Washington, and at voiceofvashon.org. The show is Real Talk. I'm Susan McCabe, your host, and we're talking about stories of arrival, stories from young immigrants and refugees that Myrna Hecht, our island former poet laureate, has collected over 8 years. I bet you have some favorite stories. Would you like to share one or two with us?
Sure. I have a couple favorite stories. I'm just going to call this young man M, okay?
Okay.
And he's from Somalia. And I'm thinking of this young man and his story for a number of reasons. One is, well, I'll get to it.
Okay.
So when I first met M, I had all of the participants in this year's project draw their own self-portrait, because my whole theme is, how do you see yourself? Tell your own story. And he drew a portrait of himself. He loves soccer. He's from Somalia. and he drew a portrait of himself, and he had one white soccer shoe on one foot and one black soccer shoe on the other. And I was just getting to know him. And I said, "Em, what's with these two shoes?" And he said, "Well, Miss Myrna, I'm new to this country. And I drew the shoes like that because that's how I want to be." I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Well, I am black on the inside, and I'm very proud of it. But now that I'm in America, I wish I could be white on the outside because I know that in America, people are afraid of young black boys, and they'll think I'm bad, but really, I'm good." So that's one story about him.
That's gut-wrenching.
It is. I have more stories. So then the next step, and this will kind of take listeners through a little bit of the timeline of the project. So the first step was to draw these self-portraits. The next step was to choose a partner that you didn't know from a different country you were from and tell a story from your childhood, making sure that you felt safe to protect yourself, not to tell a story that would bring up discomfort, lack of safety, danger, trauma, etc. So then people were to tell each other stories. So suddenly your partner becomes a container for your own story. And when the young woman told Mohammed's story, she started out by saying, when Mohammed was 4 years old, he thought he was playing with a toy. And before I go on, I'll tell you, oh, I said his name.
I know.
I'm sorry. It's okay. I won't say his last name.
Okay.
Mohammed. That's him.
It's a fairly common name.
Yes. So Mohammed said, no, wait, everybody, Miss Myrna's not doing this right. In my country, when we tell stories, we all sit in a circle on the ground. So we all went from our desk to a circle on the floor of the classroom. And then Mohammed took his jacket off and bundled it up, put it in the middle of the circle where we were all now sitting, and said, "And this is our fire. Now we can begin." And then the young woman who told his story told a story of when he was 4 years old and he was with a group of friends and they were sitting on the ground in Somalia and playing with what they thought was a round disc, a ball. And in fact, and this is a common story of the children of war, it was a landmine.
I was afraid you were going to say that.
Yes. And so when he was four, he saw his cousin did not die, but he saw her hand burn and her face, to this day, scarred and disfigured from that explosion.
Oh.
And that was his story. And he's a beautiful boy. Now, the irony is, Mohammed is a peacemaker deluxe, as of really all the young people in this project are voices of peace. And ironically, he is right now in Minneapolis in the middle of all this grief and chaos and protest, visiting an uncle. He's right there where it's happening, which feels really ironic to me.
Yes, it does.
Yeah.
Yes, it does.
And then, if I may, I can tell the opposite of the story that Mohammed told of the young woman who was his partner.
Please.
So, the young woman who is his partner, and I can say her name is also a common Afghani name for women, her name is Mariam. And Mariam's story that Mohammed told was a devastating story about what she has seen in Kabul as a child. And as he said in the story, that Mariam said to him, children should be holding red balloons. This is a quote directly from her story.
Mm-hmm.
Children should be holding red balloons. They should not be seeing the red blood of other children on their dresses. So that's a quote. So that's what I'm working with. But I want to say that through these stories and through poetry, there's a tremendous amount of courage, and that these young people, like all young people, really are, they're holding the future. And our job is to let that shine, is to let these stories come out and support them, because they've also arrived, stories of arrival, they've arrived with magnificent dreams of a better world, of a better future. That's who the young are. And that's one of my big concerns about them not being in school right now.
You know, you've had the privilege of many different cultural perspectives through this project, I presume.
Yes.
How, if at all, have those perspectives changed over the 8 years that you've been collecting these stories?
That's a great question. How have my perspectives changed from working with all these different cultures? Well, I don't think I thought about it when I first started doing this work. I was intrigued. I was honored. And I remember feeling the music of language. I remember that as I got into this work, and heard both mother tongue spoken and then heard English spoken with all these really different inflections and cadences and accents, I remember just feeling gratitude for the music of the spoken word and all these different sounds that was very musical. I think since then, it might sound nostalgic, it might sound idealistic, but working with all these different cultures is the thing, and sometimes because I'm challenged to feel hopeful in this time right now, this flavor of all these different cultures, their ancient wisdom, the respect that young people bring from a different cultural norms and values that I feel we have and that we've lost somewhat, has really emboldened me to have hope for the future and to have this deep respect for the wisdom that young people hold. I think it's a mistake to think of elders as holding wisdom. I think that, I mean, I hope many elders do, and I know that
we hope some of us get it.
Yes. But I also think we have some very old leaders right now in the world who are, quote, elders, who lack all wisdom. And this cross-cultural experience that I've been so fortunate to have has really shown me how the culture itself bears wisdom and how you don't have to be the elder in order to carry that with you and voice it and speak it and try to live it. So that's been a profound learning for me, is the wisdom of the young.
If you were, and this is probably an unfair question, if you were to identify a particular cultural value that you would like to see applied to the United States, from what country would it come and what might it be?
Well, that's a great question. Interestingly, it would be Somalia and Ethiopia. I have to say both. I have to say both countries. I'm going to do a region. I would say the Horn of Africa. Because that's Eritrea, that's Ethiopia, and that's Somalia. And those young people from the Horn of Africa consistently have a bearing, a kind of way they carry themselves, a posture, a gesture of dignity. And I see more of a downtrodden lostness in a lot, not all, of course, but in a lot of caricatures and characterizations and images of youth today. I'm not saying that's what youth is, but I see this pride in wisdom, this pride in peacemaking from these Horn of Africa cultures. And a deep pride in language and in tradition, like Mohammed saying, in my country, we would be sitting around the fire. The storyteller would be speaking to us. Many people say that the poets of Africa are Somalis. So the Horn of Africa cultures bear a lot of wisdom and dignity, I would say.
Wouldn't we love to apply that to our country? And let's hope that we learn something from our isolation. Myrna Hecht, poet and founder of the Stories of Arrival Youth Poetry Program. We have 1 minute left, and in that 1 minute, I want you to tell our listeners what it is you haven't had a chance to address yet in our conversation.
Okay, we have 1 minute. Well, I think what I would like to say is that, I would like to say that being able to tell your own story in a culture that doesn't welcome those voices has really, I think, never been more important, and that all marginalized children, and really all children, I believe, are in danger of a kind of erasure, of being swallowed up unless we hear their stories, and that those stories help set the possibility for a better future for all of us. So I want to stand by the importance of voice and storytelling from all of us, so that we understand how we cohere our identity, our culture, that we can then work together with a much greater compassion because of holding space for everyone's stories. That's what I think I'd like to say.
I think that's beautiful. And Myrna Hecht, how do we access your stories of arrival that I believe are supported by King County's For Culture program as well?
Yeah, I have some very helpful support from For Culture, from the D'Aquila Children's Foundation, and from the Satterberg Foundation, individual donations. We have a Facebook page, Stories of Arrival is on Facebook, and I have a website, MyrnaHeck.com, that has a whole section of this project on it.
Wonderful. Thank you. Thank you for joining us, Myrna Hecht. It's always a pleasure, and it's always too short.
Yes, thank you so much, Susan. Thank you.
This has been Real Talk on the Voice of Vashon. Thank you for listening. We're here every Tuesday at lunchtime and at your convenience at voiceofvashon.org. I'm Susan McCabe, your host, and so grateful for the time you've given us.